Larry, when you look at the Newland's departure, do you find it as a resignation or as a firing?
I put it in the resignation category. I think she was perhaps resigning in protest. She wasn't happy with the direction of the policy. I actually think she put more importance on the war in Ukraine than she did on U.S. support for Israel in the war against the Palestinians. And I say that because, the job she walked away from, she had been acting deputy secretary, but they had actually taken that away from her and put her back in her position as undersecretary for political affairs. And I've heard some commentary from people who've never worked at State Department, who's, treated that, oh my God, that was a demotion. Oh, heavens no. The undersecretary for political affairs is really the second most powerful position at state after Secretary of State. So deputy secretary is there as a fill-in, but doesn't really have the kind of portfolio and responsibility that undersecretary for political affairs had, which was Victoria Nuland's job. That meant she was over all policy, every embassy, every ambassador. They had to go through her. And so the fact that she walked away from that without, sort of unexpectedly. And it wasn't like, they said they accepted her resignation, be active at the end of the month. But my understanding is she stopped showing up to work. So I think she's unhappy. I think she saw the Biden administration starting to distance itself from Ukraine. They're continuing to provide the verbal support for the Ukraine and pretend that we're with them till the end. But when you get right down beneath the surface, Ukraine's clearly taken a back seat to Israel. And I don't think Nuland was happy with that.
When we look at Victoria Nuland's policy, she's a Cheney-like politician. She started her career during, if I'm not mistaken, the Bush administration. It
Oh,
was
no,
some,
no, yeah,
no.
no. She was a career foreign service officer. So she took the foreign service officer exam. She came in, I think she her first tour out, she was worked as a consular officer in some embassy overseas. And then she came back and worked in the European desk. And it was under when Strobe Talbott under Bill Clinton was the Deputy Secretary of State. That's where she sort of made her first bones, her name, and she became a chief of staff, or was on his staff direction. So was in a in an important position at the top of the State Department. Then under Bush, she moved into Dick Cheney's office over at the White House. So that made her more politically prominent. Then under Obama, they named her as the Assistant Secretary for European Affairs, which put her over Ukraine. And that's why she played such a crucial role in the 2014 coup that ousted President Yanukovych and then ended up installing Poroshenko and others. So she, my point is, she didn't just sort of suddenly show up and, 20 years ago. She was there 36, 38 years ago.
When you look at her departure, how important is that in terms of the old-fashioned policy that came along after the Cold War in the United States? She is one of the representative of those kind of policies, not just in Ukraine, in the Middle East. She was totally in charge of these kind of policies for decades.
Her departure is significant because she was a very vocal advocate for Ukraine. And so they're losing that. She's a very staunch neoconservative, which is, I think, what you're referring to. And she's not been replaced by another staunch neoconservative. So I don't know if this is a deliberate policy to try to, at the Biden administration through Blinken, were creating policies that they knew would anger her or irritate her or make her uncomfortable in supporting, and that's why she left. But she is gone, and there's nobody replacing her that's like her.
But many people are asking why now.
I think it's pretty simple. She made an assessment that the Biden administration was not going to do what was necessary to save Zelensky and try to turn the situation in Ukraine around. Therefore, she saw that Ukraine's headed for a loss, and she didn't want to be there and get the blame for the loss. So she's getting out before, you know, the thing goes completely sour. It is, you know, it's looking increasingly like Ukraine's going to be lucky to survive through the end of July or August as a country, much less as a militarily capable entity.
What does it mean for Ukraine when it comes to Ukraine and Zelensky? We know that she recently was in Ukraine, in Kiev, supporting Zelensky over Zelensky. Yeah. And Zelensky right now is going to United Kingdom.
Well, that's the story Zelensky's crowd is putting out, but Zelensky's crowd is saying he hasn't made a decision. So that's part of the problem. Nobody's really in charge anymore back in Kiev. Zelensky's power is limited. The Rada, the legislature, is being very sparsely attended these days. I think several legislators are trying to figure out how to get the hell out of Ukraine and save themselves. There's even Zelensky supposedly proposed a demobilization bill. Now, at the very time that they're short of soldiers, they're talking about demobilizing some of the existing soldiers, which is means that they're going to be even further undermanned. And I guess he's doing that as a way to try to persuade the Rada to then approve a mobilization plan. But even if you mobilize, that means you still got to train these people. You know, just because you induct them into the military doesn't mean they know what they're doing. That they even know how to salute, much less put on a uniform.
When it comes to this strange behavior that we are witnessing from Europe, from Macron, from the German Bundeswehr, they were talking about attacking Crimean Bridge with Taurus missiles.
And right.
When it comes to this strange movement in Europe, do you think it all comes from Victoria Nuland and her policy?
No. What we're seeing a variety of things take place. Primarily, we're seeing panic. France, United Kingdom, Germany in particular, are panicked. They're acting out of fear. So the intercepted conversation, I believe that was captured by the Russians and leaked through Russian channels. But there are others speculating it could have been the Singaporeans, could have been the Chinese. But my point was the leak was given to RT. It was given to the Russians. And it was given the day after Putin, in his State of Russia speech, made it very clear that the West was in the process of crossing a red line if it was going to persist in putting personnel into Ukraine to fight with the Ukrainian army and to supply them with targeting information that was killing Russian citizens and helping carry out and plan attacks on Russian infrastructure. Well, you know, he gave that speech, and then the next day this leak comes out directly implicating the Germans, the French, the Brits. And, you know, that I don't believe that that was just a coincidence. I believe it was choreographed, orchestrated. So Putin did the speech, and then the next day, boom, they trot this out. You know, do they expose some sources and methods? Potentially. But I think they did the weighed the value of getting that information out and embarrassing Germany and embarrassing the UK and embarrassing the French, which it did. So Macron is out there insisting that they're going to put boots on the ground particularly if Russia goes into Kiev. The Brits, they keep talking a tough game, but they can't even fill their armed forces or their navy. Hell, they have to advertise on LinkedIn to find somebody to be in charge of their submarine fleet. which doesn't apparently operate well. They failed in a missile launch test the other day. I love calling it ejectile dysfunction. You know, it's not quite, it's another form of ED. But, you know, the Brits are thumping their chest, but the chest is hollow and skinny, and they don't really have any military power to project anymore. Now, they can't even get one of their aircraft carriers out of port. And rumors are circulating now they're going to sell that off. So what we're seeing is a chaos within NATO. You're not seeing, NATO's not all lined up saying, oh, by God, we're standing firm against the Russians. Yeah, you got the Chancellor Olaf Scholz of Germany looking at Macron saying, we're not going into Ukraine. You're crazy. That's crazy talk. So it's a mess, is the short answer.
If you were to mention the most hardliner in the Biden administration, who could be, in your opinion?
Hardliner for towards Ukraine?
Yeah, toward Ukraine and the conflict with Russia.
It was Victoria Nuland.
That's why I'm asking that, because when she's gone, are we going to have some sort of changes in the NATO's policy, in the Washington's policy in Ukraine?
Well, you've already got changes. I mean, you know, step back and look at what has been happening. Has the United States been able to come up with more funding? No. Has the United States been able to find and produce more artillery shells? No. Is the United States able to produce and supply new artillery barrels? No. And so this isn't just developed over the last week or the last 3 weeks or a month ago. I mean, this is, you know, 3-4 months old now. So it's, you know, that's what Victoria Nuland's looking at this and recognizing that, despite what Admiral Kirby comes out and says every day, despite what the other State Department spokesman, Matthew Miller, come out and say, talk is one thing, action is another. The action of the Biden administration is not matching its rhetoric. And so she's sitting there trying to implement this policy, but she's not getting any of the backup. And then she can see where it's headed. It's headed towards a car crash. Well, is she going to be the last one standing there when it drives off the cliff? No. She gets out now and they can look back and say, hey, this wasn't my fault. I tried to warn them. They ignored me. They, you know, and she can make up the story that they forced her to resign for all I know. But with her gone, you clearly no longer have a strong voice about, oh my God, we absolutely need to support Ukraine. Because the priorities of Jake Sullivan and Anthony Blinken are this. What do we need to do to get Biden reelected? What do we need to do on the foreign policy front with respect to Ukraine, with respect to Israel, to get Biden elected? Well, we got to avoid a loss. So we're going to make all these cosmetic gestures that will make it look like something's going on or make it look like we're doing something. But at the same time, we don't really have a fix. So, you know, I think that's what's going on.
This guy who's replacing Nuland, John Bass, do you think that he's going to support Zelensky the way that Victoria Nuland did?
He'll support Zelensky the same way he supported the Afghan leaders. You know, that's his experience. Oh, yeah, we're with you 100%. Get to the airport. Get the hell out of town. You know, I think if I'm a Ukrainian and I look up and realize, my God, they appointed the guy who abandoned Afghanistan. Honey, pack your bags. We're leaving. You know, we're not waiting for the rush at the airport. We're going to get out ahead of time. And I think many of the Ukrainian leadership is, in fact, already doing that. Because that's sending a message. You know, when you go out and hire the guy that's a proven loser and you put him in charge, you're sending a message. It's just, you know, it's the same. It applies to sports, politics, war. You know, it's like, Manchester United is this great football team. And so they go looking for the guy that's got the worst record and has consistently lost every championship game. And that's who they hire. Surprise, surprise, when they start losing and they don't get back to the championship bracket. So that's what's going on in Ukraine.
How do you find the current situation on the battlefield, and how do you find the Russian strategy?
Well, what the Russians have done over the course of the past 2 weeks since the fall of Avdiivka is they have pushed the front line of the Ukrainians back considerable distance, 4 or 5 kilometers, which is a lot, all across this 120-mile line, 200-mile line. You know, you haven't really seen that kind of advance since the Soviets did it to the Germans in the Battle of Kursk in World War II. So they're, you know, the Russians continue to apply pressure all along the front. And they're using a combination of drones, FABs, the glide bombs. And then, you know, they send in the troops when they've sufficiently softened up the vulnerable points in the Ukrainian line.
We see that one of the top Russian security officials, Patrushev, he's telling that NATO's preparing for new wars and gearing up for direct clash with Russia. How we can interpret his allegations?
Well, I think what he means is that the West is going to turn to terrorism, small unit tactics, sabotage, to try to, again, it's a stupid tactic. It doesn't work. All it does is piss off the Russians, unite the Russian people, and end up with a lot more Ukrainians getting killed. But, you know, this goes back. It's like World War II mythology. You know, in World War II, you had the Special Operations Executive in Britain, the SOE, you know, these commandos creeping behind the lines, carrying out all these secret missions. Didn't change the course of the war at all. At all. But it, you know, grew into a legend. And then the CIA, the predecessor of the CIA, the OSS, Office of Strategic Services, creeping around and providing help to partisan groups and exaggerating the hell, but oh, we did this. And it was, yeah, you got great stories and you did brave things. But the war was won in the East by the Russians, by destroying Nazi divisions. That's how the war was won, ultimately. Not by all this, you know, chicken shit activity. So that's what the West is talking about. And the Russians, I think, are fully prepared to deal with it. And it's not going to alter the war, weaken Russia, cause of uprising against Putin. If anything, it's going to anger the Russian people even more, unite them more solidly behind Putin, and lead to even greater support for efforts to wipe out the Ukrainian terrorists, which means you're going to be wiping out the Ukrainian state. So, and I think you'll see Ukraine become more, Russia become more active inside Ukraine over the next 5 to 6 weeks, targeting centers that are, you know, joint NATO or joint CIA Ukrainian centers. They're going to identify them and destroy them.
Under what circumstances, in your opinion, Russia would go to Kiev? Is that possible?
No, it's very, I think it's highly likely they're going to go to Kiev. You know, if you've listened, and we may have talked about this last week, you know, Anthony Blinken, when he and Victoria Nuland both, when they described their ancestors who came out of Imperial Russia and were persecuted, who were the Russians were persecuting the Jews, and then ask him, well, where did your family live? Oh, Kiev. Oh, so you're saying now that Kiev is Russian. Thank you. So that's one of the reasons, because historically, Kiev has been considered a Russian city. So Russia is not going to let it stay with the Ukrainians. Not at all. Same applies to Odessa.
But Odessa, they're gonna take Odessa anyway. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, I don't think they'll stop until they got Odessa. They have Kiev. They control the entire left bank of the Dnieper River.
Serbian president believes that at the end of the day, West gonna get involved directly with Russia. If that happens, how do you compare the air defense system of the United States and its allies to Russia? It seems that the United States relies on their air force without having air support. How are they gonna do that if they're gonna confront Russia directly?
The United States at best has a mediocre air defense system with the Patriot. That's it. Everything else is crap. And the Patriot, frankly, is crap. Not very good. Russia's S-300 outperforms the Patriot. And it's considered, 30, 40 years old. So you've got the S-400, the S-500, and now the S-550. So Russia continues to develop and deploy the most sophisticated air defense systems in the world. The West, including Israelis, are behind. Iron Dome, Iron Dome's a bit of a joke. The Israelis can keep convincing themselves that, oh, it's a great system, it works well. But Russia's the one with the robust air defense system.
One of the great losers of this conflict is Germany. We know that the German chancellor and the German parliament were talking about that they're not willing to send troops nor long-range missiles, Taurus missiles, to Ukraine. At the same time, you see these Bundeswehr officials talking about this. Who's in charge of Germany?
They were actually talking about having to prepare a brief for the defense minister, Pistorius. And Pistorius was, that's why they're talking among themselves about what points to make, what to emphasize, what not to emphasize. If it was up to those Air Force officers, they probably would have deployed the Taurus missile. But remember what they said. Even if we do, it's not going to make a difference. That's the key. If you're going to use a weapon system, you want it to make a difference. You want it to improve your chances of winning. You don't want it to mean that no matter what you do, you're still going to lose. That's what they were saying. I think the split that is in Germany between Olaf Scholz and then the defense minister is real. It's significant. And Germany's in political chaos. That's going to get resolved. Either somebody's going to resign or quit, or ultimately they may have to vote them out. But Germany is in no position to contribute to a NATO effort to attack Russia right now.
But my question is that how much the United States would push or is able to push Germany into this conflict?
Well, I think very little now. Whose fault is it that Germany lost the pipeline? Oh, that's the United States. Yeah, they blew that up. The U.S. influence in Germany is waning. I think we're coming to a time where you're going to see the Germans maybe start making demands for the United States to withdraw its troops at places like Patch and Kelly Barracks there in Stuttgart there are several other locations that still have U.S. military personnel on the ground in Germany. At some point, I can see the Germans say, okay, get out of here. We're done with you.
Do you see Nuland's departure as a new wave of politicians in the United States, or you see the same line of thinking, the same line of ideologues continuing in Washington?
Well, the ideological camp that Nuland represents is not going silently. They're going to continue to advocate, speak out. But I think she's standing on board of this ship, but she sees it's headed towards the rocks. She's looking around, so okay, I'm going to get off now before it hits the rocks. Because when it hits the rocks, it's going to blow up, it's going to explode, it's going to be bad. And I don't want to be around to get blamed for that. That's why I think she got off now.
How about Sullivan? How about Anthony Blinken?
Yeah, Sullivan, Blinken, all these guys, they're politicians first and foremost. You know, they're political hacks. They serve the big guy. And so to that extent, they're not in the same ideological class as Nuland. But, you know, Blinken is just as delusional, if not more so. You saw him yesterday talking about, oh, the Russians are losing this and they've lost that and their capability is terrible. Yeah, it's nonsense. There's, you know, he's just making stuff up and saying it out loud, but it doesn't make it true. There's actually there's a video letter out by a group of Russian soldiers. They're begging Joe Biden to send more M1 Abrams tanks. Please, please send more. You're going, why? Because they said, well, and we promise we'll give you 10% of our bonus for every tank we blow up. You know, 10% to the big guy. So the Russian soldiers are trolling Biden. I mean, it's pretty funny when you think about it. Because they're saying, hey, we've already blown up 4 M1 Abrams. Let's do another 26.
Do you know what was the reason that Victoria Nuland didn't work with Trump?
Yeah, you know, for the life of me, I don't know why the neocon crowd chose to pick a confrontation with Trump. Because the reality is, Trump would have supported them at least on some of the issues, particularly with respect to Israel. You know, right now you can, if Trump was in the White House, Israel would be getting all of the support she needed with no hesitation whatsoever on the part of any element of the U.S. government that Trump could control. So it's quite a different situation where even had Kamala Harris out the other day calling for a two-state solution, even though the Israelis were saying, hell no, the two-state solution is dead. We're not doing two-state. It's us, the one state. Forget about it. You would think that Nuland and company, because Trump was well-disposed towards Israel, having moved the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, the first ever. You know, they're going back to Ronald Reagan promising, well, we'll put that embassy there, and it never did it. George H.W. Bush didn't do it. George W. didn't do it. Bill Clinton didn't do it. Barack Obama didn't do it. Donald Trump did. Stepped right up. Boom. Hey, it's happening. And boy, you know, all the foreign policy experts are hollering and screaming, oh, this is going to lead to a, you know, major war, major conflict. No, they were wrong.
Talking about the conflict in Gaza, it seems that the Israeli forces are having some sort of disagreement within the forces between the commanders and the soldiers. What's going on in Israel right now?
Well, I hadn't heard the one about the disagreement between the commanders and the soldiers. What I've seen and read is that you've got several of the career soldiers resigning and you know, leaving more of the reservists in charge. And the careerists are resigning out of, you know, anger over what they see as poor leadership. So you've got that going on. You know, Israel is disengaging its ground forces from Gaza and moving them up north into the border with Lebanon, Syria, where Israel, I think, is preparing to launch an attack, perhaps as early as the end of next week.
It seems that they're trying to change the law to get more soldiers from the right wing. How is that working out for Netanyahu and his administration?
They can't train enough fast enough to meet their needs. I mean, it's a reserve force. And when you look at the ranks that are held, you know, like a staff sergeant normally in the U.S. Army has been in the Army for 10 years. You know, in the Israeli army, you got 22-year-old guys as staff sergeants. Well, they haven't even been in the army for 3 years. You know, that kind of thing.
Do you think that the Biden administration is trying to find some sort of ceasefire in Gaza?
Oh yeah, no, they will. they're looking to do something from a cosmetic standpoint, that it will look good, not that it will actually be effective, not that it will actually bring the fighting to a real halt, but just to get enough of a pause so they can go to their Democrat base, the ones who are so angry with them, say, see, we tried. We're really doing something tangible for the Palestinians. Love us some more. That's what's going on.
But that's not going to change his position in the U.S. in 2024.
No. I think, you know, we talked about earlier that all this could stop if Biden just simply said, hey, no more aid. It's done. You're cut off. Unless you stop this offensive right now, unless you pull your troops back. Well, they're not going to do that. You don't have a political leader here that could get away with doing that. Not Joe Biden and not Donald Trump and not, you know, Michelle Obama or whoever.
Do you see the Netanyahu administration preparing to work with another administration? Are they preparing for that, in your opinion? How do you find their policy right now?
I don't think they're preparing, you know. I think they have one objective in mind. Survive through the next election. For both of them. On the Israeli front, Netanyahu, if he's forced from office, he's going to prison. So he's doing everything he can to stay in that position as prime minister. And on the American side, the Biden team is not, they're just trying to keep everything together so that there's no culminating crisis with the Israelis getting massacred or, the rest of the world rising up and attacking Israel. They just want to, try to keep things quiet until after the election. Then they'll be free to act.
There are two sides of this story of Netanyahu and his administration. One side says that he is continuing this war because of his position. He was facing indictments in Israel. On the other hand, as he continues this conflict, this war in Gaza, you see his position is getting weaker and weaker, and more people are against him and his policies.
Well, they're not really against his policies. I mean, Israel is really overwhelmingly united in supporting the policy of destroying the Palestinians. There was just, I think there was just an election this last week in which it wasn't the liberal, the traditional liberal, where the peace activist element of Israel comes out, that won. It was the exact opposite. It was the crazies, the extremists, the supporters of Ben-Gvir and Smotrich. They won. So, what Netanyahu's doing is he is trying to avoid resigning, even though there are calls for him to resign, but not because of the policy, because of the incompetence and not responding to October 7th quickly enough or allowing October 7th to happen. You know, that's a source of real anger. But if Netanyahu goes, it's not going to change Israeli policy towards the Palestinians. They're still screwed. You know, they're going to get hammered, whether it's Netanyahu or Benny Gantz. So, you know, Americans better, wake up to that reality that that's not going to change.
If this conflict ends tomorrow, who's the winner of this conflict in Gaza strategically?
I would say probably the Palestinians, because it has elevated their status now where there are more people talking about a Palestinian state than they were, say, a year ago or 6 months ago, even before October 7th started. I think Israel has done severe damage to itself, to its international standing, getting the South Africans to bring the case against them at the ICJ. I just saw the other day this idiot ambassador they have at the United Nations stood up and just went on this tirade against the Russians. Not very smart, because Russia and China are now much closer, and Israel's relying entirely on the United States. If the United States decides to walk away from Israel, who does Israel have to turn to? You know, in the past, they've maintained some decent relations with the Russians, with the Chinese. So what I see happening is the Israelis have destroyed their credibility dramatically. And that's not easy to recover.